I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with visual artist, among other things, Divine Zamir. Divine, how are you?
I'm great, Floyd. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you for spending some time with me today. I really appreciate it. Let's start at the beginning. What was your first artistic love?
That's a great question. My first artistic love is and was and probably will always be music. Instruments, drums, just music, the wholeness of music.
And what about music captured your, not just imagination, but your attention?
It was the conversation. It was the ability to be able to speak through music and hear music speak through me. And it was a personal conversation from, you know, my father was a bassist, professional bassist and drummer. So at a very young age, I was able to hear that language and master that language and be and use it as a way to, identify with the world, really. So I would speak musically since I was like, 2, 3 years old.
So as an artist and as you evolved into an MC, mm-hmm. What was that process like for you, especially as a woman in a traditionally male-dominated industry as it's perceived to be?
The process was straining at times. It was rewarding at times. It was victorious at times, challenging at times. I had to prove myself without even knowing that I was being challenged. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember walking into Cyphers at like 7 years old and freestyling in New York with brothers that, you know, my brother was three, four years older than me. So, but walking into these Cyphers with these men, these cats, and they were spitting, and I had to, not realizing at that time, but I had to kind of step in and prove myself because I was a child, a woman. And as I grew older, it was the same process, like really having to remember to stay focused and strong on what I believe and not selling myself out to become, accepted in the hip hop world. You know what I'm saying? So like my content of words was real. It was about what I was feeling and it was about what was going on in the world. It was very, it was bringing awareness to the table and it was accepted, you know, but there was times that I've even had management tell me like, oh, maybe you should talk about this or maybe you should talk about that being a woman. And, you know, I never swayed off of that space. So it was challenging, but again, very victorious.
Speaking about that moment of victory or having that victorious feeling for our listeners out there who may never know what it's like to be on stage, yeah, and to rock a crowd.
Yeah.
Can you describe to them what that feels like?
Wow. It's orgasmic, yo. It's like best feeling ever. It's funny too because I'm an introvert. I'm painfully shy. But it's something about the mic and the energy from the crowd that when I close my eyes and I spit my lyrics, I feel like I'm in another world, you know? I have floated and ascended to this space of complete and absolute, you know, like peace. So it's the dopest feeling, especially when, you know, you're growing up in Atlanta or not even growing up in Atlanta, but musically growing up here in Atlanta and really establishing my foundation musically here and having the crowd be able to spit your lyrics back to you. That's the dopest thing ever. It's dope.
Does that become addictive?
Yeah, very. I want it. I actually want it right now as we are speaking. Yeah.
So when you came to Atlanta, was it to pursue your musical career or was it for something else? Talk about that transition.
It was to pursue my musical career. I had linked up with the Sistren. I was in a group, Last Lyricist. So I had just left New York, and my brother was in Orlando. So I was traveling there, and I linked up with the sister, and she's a vocalist, and we started this group called Last Lyricist. So we were like, yo, you know, Orlando unfortunately is very small, very touristy. Didn't really support the music or was able to give us what we were looking for. So 8 years ago, we were going to go back up to Brooklyn, but we stopped in Atlanta to drop her daughter, you know, her daughter off to her father so that we can just kind of have free range and really do what we needed to do. And we stopped here, and our car got messed up. So we were here for a couple of days, and we met this cat who was a producer, and we linked up. So Atlanta happened haphazardly, actually. It was a stopping point to another point on my linear transition. But I'm glad we ended up here because it's been a beautiful journey musically.
What year was that?
That was 2006.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, given that Atlanta was not a planned stop, or not, I guess your stay was not a planned stay. You did plan to stop to drop off your friend's daughter, but
true.
But given the musical industry in hip hop that has started to evolve over the last, you know, at that point maybe 15 years, was that something that was attractive to you in terms of trying to figure out how to navigate your career in Atlanta?
I'm gonna be real. Nah, Atlanta wasn't attractive to me at all, which is the funny part because, you know, I'm a city girl. So when we and it just so happened that where we stopped in Atlanta was Riverdale. So I felt like I was surrounded by forests, you know, and I'm like, well, where's the city? Like, where's this big chocolate city that everyone talks about? And I came here in 94 as well to go to a college tour for Morris Brown and Clark, but never was accepted, but just never wanted to come back because it didn't move me. You know what I mean? But it was something that just started to grow on me, just seeing all of the beautiful black people and just seeing, feeling a lineage of history and everything that's happened in Atlanta, it became home. My partner always says that she's a Reef-right Southerner. She's from Jersey. But it's kind of like that feeling. Like, I feel like I'm a Southern girl to heart now. So it kind of just grew on me. And linking up and seeing the underground hip-hop that was here, it wasn't on the surface. But when you were able to really dig and find those pockets, it was sexy, you know what I'm saying? So it definitely kept me here, and I see a beautiful journey ahead in Atlanta for sure.
So all of this time, you've been focusing on your musical career.
True.
When did you first start to pick up the paintbrush or the pen or the pencil as a visual artist?
I've always, essentially, I've always dabbled and the visual aspect, again, because of my father. My baba was an artist. He was musical artist. He also was a carpenter, and he also did drawings, caricatures, everything. So I would always kind of mimic what he did, but it wasn't a love. So I guess to really answer that is when I became in love with spreading my emotions visually was just a year and a half ago. Even when I was doing music and I first moved here, I had canvas and, you know, I would just kind of throw the colors because I think color therapy is so essential to our growth. But as far as having a conversation with the canvas, that started a year ago.
So let's talk about that transition or maybe that inflection point in your life. You were involved in a pretty dramatic accident. Can you talk about what happened and where were you, you know, what the situation was around that?
Yeah, I was right in my own backyard. I was getting my hair cut from my brother, Mike Flo, actually. He cuts my hair. He lives probably about 3 blocks away from me. And we were talking about music and everything that day. You know what I mean? It was a real dope, beautiful day. But, you know, if we all have things that happen to us to some extent that are arduous at times, right? So you can feel something's about to happen, or I could. I didn't know what it was. I wasn't sure, you know, if I was about to get rained on, or I didn't know. But leaving his house that particular day was funny because he has this little dog named Womack. And he was walking, you know, walking out with me to walk his dog. And the dog started following me on my bike. He's like, nah, D, you good. Like, he doesn't follow anybody. He's going to stay with me. So I cross over Hosea Williams in Atlanta. And the dog is crossing with me. I was like, oh, yo, Flo, get your dog. And he's like, nah, yo. And at this point, he's running, you know, to get his puppy that almost got hit by a car. So I thought that was the infraction and emotion that I was feeling. I thought that was the something that was about to happen. So I threw my bike down, went to, you know, race to stop this car, to pick up the puppy, and the puppy was safe, boom. You know, Flo got his dog back, boom. Hugged next, boom. Got on my bike. Now, at this point, I'm closer to home. I'm a block away. So I'm feeling a little better, you know. And I'm riding down the street. I can see my house, and this car is behind me and, you know, proceeds to blow the horn. And I'm like, yo, you know, let me the street's really congested and narrow. So I had to pass parked cars on both sides of me to get out the way of this car behind me. So I'm, you know, I'm riding, and the car, as soon as there was a clear way, I'm, you know, motioning my bike to get out this car's way, and he nicks my back tire. And that's all I remember. The car didn't stop, kept going, boom. I wake up, didn't even know my leg was broken at the time. I see my house, you know, I'm calling home for someone to come help me. But I just, you know, I walk home, I walk my bike home, and then I collapse on my porch, and that's all I remember from that point. And, you know, yeah.
Broken knee.
Broken knee, yeah.
Anything else?
Bruise, scars, but just as far as breaks was the knee.
Okay.
Yeah, concussion and all that good stuff, but you know.
All that good stuff. So after surgery, and maybe once you mentally adjusted to, okay, this is my path to recovery.
Yeah.
Talk about what you were thinking about in terms of rehabilitation, in terms of your physical space, your, like, how you felt your body. Talk about that.
By trade, I'm a massage healer. So I thought that being holistic and in my healing process would have helped me in that moment. As far as chemistry goes, I'm like, I don't want the drugs. I really didn't want the surgery. You know, I thought that I would be able to heal myself. And this was the first time that I've ever had any external that stopped my mobility, issue with my body. I felt that I was fairly healthy prior to this accident. And in that moment that I realized that I couldn't even connect with this injury, I couldn't even connect with, you know, the other parts and chakras that I would normally use to heal myself, there was such a disconnection that I actually reached for the Vicodin. I reached for the bottle, you know, because it was painful. And in that moment, I felt like I had given up, you know, what I innately knew to heal myself. So it was a very confusing, space for me, you know, the first couple of months of this transition with this accident. And I realized that at that moment, I wasn't really getting better. The doctor who had did the original surgery didn't really give the instructions that was needed. And because I was at this point drugged up, I wasn't healing myself either. So I was just kind of laying there. And my you know, I had to have two more surgeries following because of scar tissue and all other kind of ailments that were happening because of the first surgery went so poorly. So it was a very interesting, difficult space for me as far as healing. But once I was able to release that Vicodin grip and come back to my senses and reality, you know, and that's when a healing process truly began.
Talk about the Vicodin or I guess from the perspective of that grip or that haze,
yeah,
or what it does to you emotionally. Talk about that.
It clouded me emotionally. It actually completely. And it's funny because people wanted my prescriptions to sell or to take for themselves. And I was like, why? Because I felt like I was suffocating. Like, I couldn't tap into divine. I couldn't find me, you know. I was, like, walking with a blindfold on through a healing field, but tripping over my own damn feet because it just left me completely lifeless, you know what I'm saying? It's like one of those commercials, you know, you could take this pill, but you may lose your eyes, your heart, your feeling to touch and taste. But you could take this pill. It'll take care of your knee. So, you know, it was like the cold turkey was real because I don't even have an addictive personality. But for the first couple of months, it allowed me to just kind of be numb, you know, and not feel the pain or... And it was a lot of emotions too, because again, I was in music and I was on my bike and, you know, working and moving, and I have a family, children, and so my life completely transitioned. So it kind of just allowed me to be in a numb phase space, and a part of me liked it, but the part of me that was the bigger part of me that was fighting against it did not like it. And, you know, thank God that part won.
How did the support system around you respond or react to this phase of your recovery?
Supportive.
Okay. Even when you were in the Vicodin haze, they understood that?
Yeah, because, you know, again, I think because I don't, and it's a blessing, I don't have an addictive personality. When I call what I call a Vicodin grip, somebody else may call Kool-Aid. You know what I mean? Like, it wouldn't do anything else for anyone else, but you know, you can open a Malbec, and I can smell the cork, and I can kind of get, you know, drowsy. So I was taking like half of a half, but it was still enough for me to just kind of be numbed. But they didn't know what to expect. Even if it wasn't the Vicodin, it was just mom's on the couch and she's not moving. You know what I mean? Or she's not cooking. She's not doing this. She's not doing that. So that, in a sense, was. It was a lot of adapting, but it was a transition for everyone, really.
During this phase, when you weren't able to be as mobile as you were accustomed to being, you got more into your visual art.
Yeah.
When did you begin to rediscover that part of you?
My partner, she brought me a sketch pad, and I thought I was going to use it for lyrics, but the lyrics didn't come. But what started to come was these doodles and these marks that I was making that I realized was my healing. So I would, you know, doodle and trace and do all of these different drawings that after I looked at it, I would just sit there, and it helped me through this process. And then it became, you know, the colors and a canvas, and I was painting on my back because it was, you know, my leg was straight. I couldn't really sit, or so I just started painting on my back and seeing the colors even drip on me. So it was a very healing space. And it reminded me of why I was so attracted to painting in the beginning, because it was that color therapy.
I notice in a lot of your paintings, at least the ones that are on display here at Wonder Root for this exhibit,
There
are lots of circles in lots of the pieces. Like that, I mean, I found that as a repetitive motif, if you will, in a lot of your work.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
I think it's a duality. Like it was definitely, you know, so. I even tell my children, you know, you stub your toe, the first thing we do is we hold our breath. We grab the injured space, and then we jump and we scream or we do whatever, right? But we don't take the time to heal. And that's what I was doing in the first couple of months, especially with the Vicodin. And that's why that one piece is called, the reality of Vicodin, because it was just it was a hot mess, really. You know what I mean? And I wasn't able to stop and think, but I was holding my breath and not breathing, not healing. Most of the circles are actually representing my patella, my knee. And the break that I had, the fracture, is a tibial plateau. So it's actually where your patella sits in on your tibia, and it's a plate, but it's a circle on top of that flat bone that was broken. So my patella was just now supported by two pins. So this circular joint, that this very small bone – on the you know, when you talk about the size of bones, this is a very small one in comparison to the other ones, but it's very important because it's completely directed to your mobility. So that reminded me to go and not scream and hold my breath, but to look at my knee, to heal my knee, you know, to caress my knee. And it allowed me to heal myself. So that reminded me. And it's also a cipher and transition and a portal. So it represented several different aspects of getting through and getting off that damn couch and getting back to my life.
You said something or wrote something before where you talked about your work is this blend of art and mathematics.
Yeah.
Talk more about that.
I think, you know, again, it's part of the healing process. My father was like a walking God for me, you know, like he was my religion, if you will. And he taught me math at a very young age because math is music and math is science. Math is healing. Like, you can't play the bass, you can't play the drums if you don't understand the science or the mathematical sequence behind it. So, again, I'm being taught at a very young age this process. It's the same thing with art. It's the same application that applies to the layers and the marks that I'm making mathematically. It's a connection that allows me to truly layer the canvas or layer whatever is being layered in a sequence. So it's really just about sequence and healing and understanding your body and understanding your brain and how it works and understanding the numbers that are, you know, being coded into everything that we do.
Thinking back to before your accident, up to now, do you have a different respect for the body? And what I mean by that is this physical form that we all carry. And as you have dealt with repairing that, as you have dealt with not having that be the most optimal form that it has been for you,
right?
How has your respect for, like, the physical body changed?
Dramatically. It made me realize how vulnerable we are. And in a physical sense, you know, I don't know if it's changed per se, but just really highlighted I think I'm more cautious. I definitely wasn't a cautious person prior, you know, would jump off of anything, walk anywhere, go anywhere, you know, just kind of tomboyish or whatever have you, but just a little bit more cautious now.
And has that influenced how you communicate to your children about their body or their bodies, rather?
Yeah, it definitely. What I'm trying not to do is implant fear, right? Because that was what happened, was real for me. I remember waking up from that accident and knowing I was out because, you know, I don't know if you ever seen stars, but the stars were there and it was like, whoa, yo, you know, what happened? But I think I'm a little cautious with them, and I'm trying not to be so overbearing. Like, my son wants to start riding his bike to school. He's about a mile and a half out. And, you know, I'm, like, a little nervous with it. But then I realize that we are in control of everything that we do. So just trying to balance all of it out still, you know what I'm saying? Like, and just letting be and be free again, because it was truly an accident and it happens. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Going back to that victorious feeling and being on stage as an MC, where is that analogy to where you are with your visual work? Where's that same feeling for you when it comes to painting?
Wow. I think it's, I don't know if it'll ever be the same. I don't even know if it's a comparable. I don't even know if it's a, if it is an analogy, it's completely different. It's kind of like that to me was giving the world my emotions, right, and how I felt. This to me, as far as painting, is inviting a world into my emotions and how I feel. So it's one is outward, one is inward. When I'm by myself and I need and like to paint alone, it's kind of like writing in a diary, if you will. Perhaps that's that same feeling, but it's not an outward feeling. And once it's presented, once it's given, I almost, even at the opening here, I kind of, you know, again, because I am painfully shy, and I kind of just want to close my eyes, and y'all can watch, but I don't want you watching me, if that makes any sense. So it's just a difference. It's a different vibration.
Visual music.
Visual music.
Is how you described your work.
Yeah.
So the music is still there. But I'm guessing that maybe these moments for you, because you are letting folks in, maybe these moments of victory are, these are personal moments of victory.
My brethren and I, Massive, which is the last group I was in, Star Child, we would sit hours and hours. And it was a different formula as opposed to it was with Aziza and I for Last Lyricist. Ours were more freestyle. We would get on the stage and just do whatever. He and I would build these conversations lyrically and put them on beats, on music, on instrumentation. That's what painting's like for me. And when that was happening, I didn't like anybody in the studio with us because it was a very intimate moment. So it's definitely visual music, but it's kind of like writing and hearing life being the beat and my art being the lyrics. So it's kind of that space of solitude, but you know, once it's completed, I can then give it.
Going back to this notion of you at being an artist in different capacities, both with your music and with your visual work, and you talk about your father being such a tremendous influence on you. As a woman, as a mother, as a partner, how do you try to input or invest into your children in a similar way as your father poured into you?
That's a great question. And it's not even just my children, Floyd. It's children of the world. Like, the fact that these art programs and music programs are being taken out of our communities, it hurts my heart, which is why I really, you know, on an investment aspect, really want to build my finances so I can start the I Heart My City chapter of my life, which is going to give back to the community, because art is by far the most important aspect, in my belief, of a child's development, of a child's growth, which then in turn makes that child more adaptable to learning the sciences and, you know, and the maps and the life lessons that will come. But I remind my children, it's we live in a technical world, but they have to put their phones down, you know, especially from Monday through Friday. Like, get a book, paint, get a brush, get aerosol can. I don't care what you do, but tap into your inner self and bring that out and create a space where we're learning always, you know, and the arts and music are just, again, not to be redundant, but it's just fundamental. It's the fundamental of that building block.
All right. Well, last question here as we wrap up. When do you feel most victorious right now?
When do I feel most victorious? Every moment, every moment. Life is so beautiful right now. Like, it's amazing. So just driving here, just having a conversation. We were listening to NPR and listening to, you know, Tiny Desk music and art and every moment, children, like everything is great, you know?
All right. Divine Zamir, let all of our listeners know how they can find out more about you and your work.
Yeah. It's social media, Instagram, Twitter, Divine_Zamir, Z-A-M-I-R. Or you can go to my website, which is wiz, divinearts.com. Come to Wonder Root. We actually have another exhibition. We as an I, as an all of me, exhibition coming up at Studio 7 on November 9th. So come check that out as well.
All right. Divine, Thank you for your time.
Floyd, thank you.